Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in supportive care and is the author of Choices in Breast Cancer Treatment. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken Miller sits down for a conversation about the treatment of brain tumors with Dr. Joachim Behring. Dr. Behring's an associate professor of neuro-oncology at Yale, and he's the director of the Yale Cancer Center Brain Tumor Program.
Let's start out by talking about, you know, some of the basic information. When people talk about a brain tumor, what are they referring to?
Well, the two major categories of brain tumors are those that primarily affect the brain, meaning that start in the brain, and then there are metastatic brain tumors. Patients who have cancer in the lung and the breast can develop metastases, seeding of their tumor to the brain. So those are the two major categories.
Now, what's more common?
More common are the metastatic tumors, probably by about fivefold, maybe even tenfold more common.
Okay. So there are a group of patients, people who unfortunately develop a cancer that starts in the brain itself.
Yes.
In broad categories, you know, what are the different types of cancer that arises in the brain?
There are a large variety of primary brain tumors. The largest group of brain tumors is called the group of gliomas. Now, that term is derived from a normal type of cell that exists in the brain, and that cell type is called glial cell. So tumors that resemble those cells and likely are derived from those cells are called gliomas. And amongst those tumors, there are benign variants and malignant variants, cancerous variants. The most common tumor, unfortunately, is a malignant one, and it's called glioblastoma.
Now, if we were to look at the difference between, you said a glioma, which is a low-grade one, and a glioma or a glioblastoma, which you're just referring to, what are the differences? I mean, do they look alike under the microscope? Do they look different? Do they behave differently?
Again, there's a large group, and some are quite different from some of the low-grade tumors are quite different from the high-grade ones, and those tumors may be even curable by taking them out. However, there is an overlap between the quote-unquote low-grade ones and the malignant ones. Those tumor groups are called astrocytoma or oligodendroglioma, and they can be diagnosed at a stage where they look very benign, but over the years they can transform into a higher-grade tumor and then behave more aggressive. So there is an overlap between the two groups, and one can transform into the other, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask a question I think a lot of people are wondering about, which is what goes wrong with a normal cell to make it become malignant? And, you know, and along those lines, what are the risk factors?
Well, there are many very well-established risk factors for various types of systemic cancer. However, for brain cancer, we haven't really identified major risk factors. The only one where there's a clear correlation between exposure and later development of brain cancer is radiation. So patients who maybe in their childhood had a tumor affecting the brain, let's say patients with leukemia who required radiation to the brain because the leukemia had spread there, they then later in life are at risk of developing a brain tumor in the area that was radiated. Other risk factors really have not been consistently linked to brain cancer. A very small subset of patients with brain cancer have a genetic predisposition, but I would say at a center like ours, we may see one or two cases a year amongst over 100 of newly diagnosed cancers. So that is quite rare.
All right. Perhaps not a million-dollar question, but a common question people ask, do cell phones cause brain cancer?
I don't think at this point there's any evidence that they do. There are many studies across the world, most of which seem to suggest there's no correlation between the use of cell phones and the risk of developing brain cancer. However, I think, as with many other exposure risks, many times we learn decades after the exposure was initiated that there may be a slight increase in risk. But again, there's absolutely no evidence, neither from animal experiments nor from studies in humans, that cell phone use increases the risk of brain cancer. And cell phones have been around now for a long time. So I think the likelihood that we'll ever establish a link is quite low.
Okay, which I have to say is reassuring, because I mean, just walking here this morning, I mean, you almost see everybody with cell phones in their hands. What typically are the symptoms that someone would have? I mean, you're seeing a large number of new patients here. What typically did they tell you?
There are the two most common symptoms a patient presents with who is found to have a brain tumor are headaches and seizures. Now, a headache is obviously a very common symptom and probably one of the most common symptoms that people seek medical advice for. And, you know, not with every headache one has to be concerned about developing a brain tumor, obviously. Headaches are stress-related. Migraine is another stress-unrelated, very common form of headaches. Various other types of headaches that are not caused by brain tumors. There are a couple of features that should alert somebody who has a chronic headache that they should have this checked out. The typical brain tumor headache is worst upon awakening in the morning, or patients even wake up in the middle of the night. They may feel nauseated. The headache then, once patients get up and walk around, gets better during the day, and at the end of the day, they may not even have it. A headache that is chronic, that gets worse week after week, month after month, that becomes more frequent, that is in general the type of headache that you don't just want to treat with over-the-counter medication, but see a doctor for.
All right. That's important advice. But I think also just to reassure people, as you were saying, that, I mean, headaches are common and thankfully it sounds like most of the time are not related to a cancer, but really to just benign causes. How do you detect a cancer in the brain?
Well, once you have taken a history from the patient, examined the patient, and there is a concern for a tumor, next step is usually obtaining an imaging study of the brain. And nowadays, at least here in the U.S., the most commonly used diagnostic test is an MRI scan of the brain with contrast dye. It's the most sensitive and specific non-invasive test we have, and that usually can rule out the presence or absence of a brain tumor quite well.
I want to ask you a little bit more about, there's been a lot of talk about newer ways to really image the brain and understand how a tumor, the area where a tumor is, relates to the functional parts of the brain that really control speech and vision. So if you're contemplating having a patient have surgery and you want to relate it to what they may lose in terms of function, how do you do that using imaging studies?
There are a couple of new, very interesting techniques, and the ones that are used nowadays are really all MRI-based. So for the patient, there's not much of a difference having a regular MRI scan and one of these specialized MRI scans. One that is very commonly used if surgery is needed in an area that carries very important function like speech or strength on one side of the body. An MRI scan called a functional MRI is obtained, where the patient is asked, while lying in the MRI scanner, to perform a certain task, either read from a text or listen to a verbal command, or simply squeezing a softball in one hand. And then the MRI can actually pick up differences of blood perfusion on the surface of the brain, and areas that are activated generally require an increased oxygen demand and blood supply. So that relative difference is picked up by the scan, and then a computer program can generate a color-coded map where the activated area is highlighted in relationship to the tumor. And that provides very important information to the neurosurgeon in determining, well, can this tumor be safely removed, or would removal likely result in a neurologic deficit? And then only a biopsy would be performed.
Yeah, I have to say it sounds fascinating.
It is.
Along the same lines, I've heard of this is for a longer period of time of having a neurologist or a specially trained person in the OR doing an EEG or doing other studies. Can you tell us a little bit about that, sort of the intraoperative part of things?
Yeah, tests like that are still indispensable. The preoperative imaging capabilities have dramatically improved. However, in the very end, when it comes down to making a decision as to whether a piece of the tumor can be safely resected or not, the neurosurgeon still does some intraoperative testing. And there are various options, such as simply stimulating the surface of the brain with an electrode. And if a tumor is located very close to the language area, sometimes patients are only lightly sedated for the surgery, and then in the operating room, the medication is briefly withdrawn. The patient is asked to actually read something, and before and after stimulation. And if there's a change in language function after stimulation, the surgeon knows that they cannot remove that part of the brain. Also, stimulation in a patient who is sedated of the strength control area in the brain results in contraction of muscles on the opposite side of the body. So if a surgeon elicits that kind of response with stimulation, he knows also this is an area where they can't go.
So, you know, fortunately, it sounds like there's really, aside from the physical exam and really your expertise, you also have a lot of tools available to you to help sort of help make those decisions.
Yeah, the technology has evolved quite dramatically. And I think while there are a lot of tumors still that we cannot cure, the outcome from surgery has improved simply based on the fact that we can determine the relationship of the tumor to the normal brain much better.
How is a biopsy done?
A biopsy can be done by two ways. Either the skull is opened, like for regular surgery, and then a small piece of the tumor is taken out. Another way that is less invasive is what you call a stereotactic biopsy. So a patient is taken to the operating room, a small burr hole is drilled into the bone, into the skull, and then a fine needle is inserted into the area of interest, into the tumor, and then a very small tissue cylinder. It's only about a millimeter thick and about a third of an inch long is retrieved, and then the pathologist looks at the tissue.
Are there ever times or experiences you've had where you're unsuccessful at getting a biopsy and you have to just decide to treat someone?
Sure, that does happen. If a brain tumor is in a very critical area of brain function, if it's very deep in the brain, if it's in the lower part of the brain, what's called the brainstem, where a lot of vital functions like breathing function is located, sometimes either a biopsy cannot be performed, it would be unsafe for the patient, or only a very small piece can be retrieved and based on which a diagnosis is not possible. In that setting, and I think that is rare, but it does happen, if the patient's symptoms progress, we're bound to mm-hmm. treat based on imaging appearance and other test results. We simply have to treat for the most likely diagnosis.
Yeah, and those must be very difficult situations. Let me ask you, before we take a break, what is the primary form of treatment for people with a cancer that arises in the brain?
For most cancers of the brain, for most malignant brain tumors, the treatment approach really requires several specialties. Typically, the surgeon is the first involved, either for biopsy or removal of the tumor. Secondly, a radiation oncologist provides radiation to whatever of the tumor is left and possibly also to some degree of normal appearing brain around the tumor. And then thirdly, chemotherapy is a tool for many different types of brain tumors. There are variations. There are particular tumors that can be cured by surgery. There are other tumors that are very sensitive to radiation, then other tumors that go away with chemotherapy alone. But as a general rule, for the most common tumors, like glioblastoma, all three treatment modalities are required.
Well, you're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers. We're here discussing the latest in treatment options for brain tumors with Dr. Jochen Behring, who is an expert in the treatment of these type of tumors at the Yale Cancer Center. We are going to take a break for a medical minute, and we'll be right back with you.
It's estimated that over 2 million men in the U.S. are currently living with prostate cancer. One in six American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to experimental medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm joined today by Dr. Joachim Behring, who is a associate professor at the Yale Cancer Center and an expert on the treatment of people with malignant tumors of the brain. Joachim, we just started talking about treatment of cancers that arise in the glial cells, glioblastoma, and tumors like that. I also know you're an expert in the treatment of patients with lymphoma of the brain. So can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, we typically think of lymphomas and lymph nodes, and how does it arise in the brain?
Yeah, brain lymphoma is quite a rare tumor. There are only about 1,000, maybe 1,400 cases a year in the United States altogether. And just for comparison, colon cancer, prostate cancer, there are over 100, 200,000 cases a year in the U.S. So it is an order of magnitude less frequent. Lymphoma, you're right, typically affects lymph nodes, yes, but also other organs of the body can be affected, like the liver or the spleen or the heart, the lungs, or the brain. Of all lymphomas that arise in the United States, only 1 in 50 affects the brain alone. And it's a rather peculiar tumor in that it seems to affect really only the brain. Only at the very last or late stage, when the tumor relapses after initially successful treatment, does it leave the brain and spread to other parts of the body. So there's a unique predilection for the brain of these tumor cells. And we believe that probably these tumors arise from cells that at some point during the patient's lifetime was primed to attack some intruder, a bacterium, a virus in the brain. And that's why they later then seek out the brain again. But that is a hypothesis that hasn't been proven yet. But it seems to be true for other types of lymphoma.
Now, if a patient has a central nervous system lymphoma, is the treatment in that case surgery? Is it chemotherapy? Is it radiation?
Lymphoma happens to be exquisitely sensitive to chemotherapy, so, and it has a rather typical appearance on MRI. If we suspect a lymphoma, typically the surgical procedure is limited to a stereotactic biopsy, meaning biopsy through a small burr hole. If the diagnosis is confirmed, then chemotherapy is administered. There are different types of chemotherapy regimens. All of them include a drug called methotrexate. And that is a drug that's given by vein every 2 to 4 weeks over the course of 6 to 12 months. And as I said, there's about a 60% to 70% chance that the tumor will go away with that treatment,
which is excellent, and probably a lot better than it was years ago.
The treatment paradigms have changed. Yes, in the old days, these tumors too were treated with surgery and then radiation, and patients either had severe side effects from those treatments down the line, anywhere 6 months to 12 months down the line, or the tumor relapsed fairly quickly. So about 15 years ago, there was a change in the treatment paradigm, and that has improved the outcome of patients with these tumors dramatically.
Well, I want to switch to a different topic. We've talked some about surgery. We've talked some about chemotherapy. Your team are also experts in the use of gamma knife radiation. So what is that?
Gamma knife is a device that provides radiation or a radiation boost to a defined area within the brain. The core feature of a gamma knife is actually a large shielding device, and the radiation source surrounds this shielding device. Now, there are over 100 burr holes in that shielding device, and they can be focused on an area within the brain that's abnormal. May that be a tumor, there are other indications for this procedure as well. The advantage is if the X-ray beam comes from different directions and all the beams meet in one target, the exposure of normal brain surrounding the problem is minimized, whereas the tumor exposure is maximized. That is in contrast to standard radiation, where the X-ray beam comes maybe from three or four directions, and that exposes normal brain much more than gamma knife does. Now, gamma knife is not for everybody, and tumors that are not very well circumscribed, and unfortunately most of the primary brain tumors are not good targets for gamma knife, simply because the treatment then only focuses on the very core of the tumor, but does not address less obvious tumors surrounding this lesion.
All right, so actually let's drill down a little bit further on this, because I have to say it's a wonder. Your description of the gamma knife has been actually very helpful to me to think about. So for a patient with a glioblastoma, which you were saying is the most common type of brain tumor, who has surgery, would you want to give them external radiation, the typical radiation, or would you want to use gamma knife typically?
The standard treatment protocol for glioblastoma consists of a standard radiation protocol, meaning you call this quote-unquote involved field radiation, where not only the tumor, whatever is left of it after surgery, is exposed to radiation, but also a safety margin of about two-thirds to of an inch to 1 inch that surrounds the tumor. And that simply addresses nature of the tumor. The tumor is not circumscribed. It's not surrounded by a capsule. It's not sharply separate from the brain, but it has very fuzzy edges. There are tumor cells that infiltrate the brain surrounding the tumor that's visible on MRI scan. Gamma knife is used for patients with glioblastoma. However, there are very selective indications for it. If a patient after surgery has a very small residual or after initially successful treatment has a very small recurrence, that may be an appropriate target for gamma knife. Gamma knife has been studied formally for glioblastoma as an addition to standard radiation, and unfortunately, that did not lead to a survival advantage.
You know, I think people sometimes have the impression that high tech, you know, when you hear about gamma knife or cyber knife or things like that, this assumption is better, but in this case, it's not.
That's right. I think there's a selected a small group of patients that would benefit from additional radiation boosts, but one really has to select these very carefully.
All right. If you would tell us a little bit about, firstly, what does adjuvant therapy mean, and how does it apply? Just that term, and how does it apply to people with brain tumors?
Adjuvant really means additional therapy after surgery. That's what we mean with adjuvant. So in a way, radiation treatment is an adjuvant treatment, and so is chemotherapy. And for patients with primary brain tumors, as I mentioned, most patients do need both the primary treatment, which is surgical removal of as much of the tumor as we can, and then secondly, adjuvant treatments such as radiation and chemotherapy.
All right. And what type of chemotherapy is used for patients like these?
For the most common primary brain tumor, the standard of care now includes a drug that's called temozolomide. It's a drug that is given by mouth, and it alters the molecule within the cancer cell that carries the genetic information, the DNA molecule. And by doing so, it interferes with the ability of the cancer cell to divide, which is ultimately the basis for tumor growth.
What are some options for patients with brain tumors, and in particular, any clinical trials that are available?
There is a large number of clinical trials available. I think over the last 10 years, we've seen numerous new drugs enter the field and being tested in clinical trials. There are a couple of drugs that are of particular interest to patients with primary brain tumors. One I would want to highlight is a group of drugs that targets the tumor's ability to grow new blood vessels. When tissue grows at a high rate, like in cancer, tumor cells and tumor growth is dependent on oxygen supply, nutrient supply that requires growth of blood vessels. So there are drugs that can specifically target the tumor's ability to do that. There are different mechanisms. Some of these drugs are given by vein. Other drugs are given by mouth. For some drugs, we already have some clinical trial data that are quite encouraging. There's a drug called bevacizumab that has gone through the first phases of clinical trial. There are other drugs that are a little earlier in their development. However, we don't have definitive trial results yet that would tell us, well, these drugs need to be included in the standard of care. But we're probably getting close to at least identifying one or two more drugs that may be added to what we've been doing so far, the radiation and the standard chemotherapy.
You know, it makes me think back to the situation with lung cancer and colon cancer, where bevacizumab, or is also called Avastin, seems to work synergistically together with chemotherapy. And might that apply to treatment of people with brain tumors?
Sure, there is certainly evidence from experiments that there may be synergism between bevacizumab or other drugs that attack the ability of the tumor to grow blood vessels with standard forms of chemotherapy. There's a drug called irinotecan that, at least in experiments, has been shown to have a greater effect on tumor cells if it's given in addition to bevacizumab.
Now, some of the research that's going on at Yale is very exciting. For example, use of viruses to attack the brain, new methods of delivering therapy. Can you tell us some about those?
Yeah, there are several groups at Yale with an interest in brain tumors, and I think the two different topics you mentioned are probably the hottest that are currently ongoing. One group in our department, led by Tony van den Poel and Guido Wallmann, is trying to identify viruses that not only have the ability to specifically infect tumor cells, but also then kill them. And they have been successful, and they have shown in animal experiments that tumors that are growing in the brain can be successfully treated with this. However, there's still a long way to transfer this knowledge now into a clinical trial where patients are actually treated. Now, there are examples of different viruses that have already been used in clinical trials in humans. This would be a refined version of those viruses, and I'm hopeful that over the course of a few years, maybe we get there and can use some of these new tools. There's another group at Yale that's led by Dr. Salzman, the director of the Department of Biomedical Engineering, and he's developing quote-unquote micro-vehicles with which we can administer drugs or other treatments directly to the brain. Those vehicles are called nanoparticles, and they're really microscopic particles. They can be coated with certain molecules that renders them specific for brain cancer cells. They can be loaded with different agents that can attack brain cancer. So this is quite an exciting field of research, and I think that's a little closer to clinical use than the viral treatment.
I have to say, sitting here with you, I just want to share with the listening audience, I can see your eyes sort of light up when you're talking about these. It's exciting, isn't it?
These are exciting times, yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. How can a patient access help from the Yale Brain Tumor Center?
We can both evaluate patients as a primary consultation and then treat them, or we also provide second opinion. So if a patient is interested in simply coming or sending us material, we review the case in our multidisciplinary tumor board and then provide an opinion as to how we would approach the case. But in general, we have a clinical coordinator, Elizabeth DeAndrea. She can be reached at Yale at 203 737-1671. And she is the first contact person through which then patients enter the system. And she makes then the decision, should that patient be seen first by a surgeon, by a radiation doctor, or by myself, or one of our other medical oncologists.
Well, terrific. We've been you've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I want to thank our guest, Dr. Joachim Behring, for what has been a really interesting session for me, and I hope for you as well. Joachim, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And until next week, I'm Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. Next week, you'll meet Dr. Melinda Irwin, who joins Ken Miller to talk about exercise and cancer prevention. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.